This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support this free service by September 5th and you could win a Mini Cooper S convertible. Go to KCRW.com for details.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
North Korea, the U.S., and nuclear weapons.
Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. On the eve of tomorrow's reopening of six-nation talks about nuclear weapons, the U.S. and North Korea have held an unexpected meeting. That's what North Korea has long demanded, but the U.S. official in charge says they were just trying to get acquainted. On To the Point, we'll look at the prospects for ending a stalemate that goes back 50 years to the end of the Korean War. If the talks fail, how dangerous is North Korea? We'll hear about a race against time for America and the rest of the world. On Reporter's Notebook later on, NASA will waive safety rules and launch Discovery tomorrow. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Mormon Alney, back with To the Point. The U.S. and North Korea have held bilateral consultations on the eve of tomorrow's six-nation nuclear disarmament talks. On To the Point, does that increase the chance of a breakthrough in one of the longest and most dangerous stalemates since World War II? On Reporter's Notebook, NASA says it'll waive its flight rules and launch Discovery tomorrow, even if fuel sensor problems continue. We'll find out why. First, this news update. Four unions, representing almost a third of organized labor, have boycotted this week's meeting of the AFL-CIO. And starting at this hour, they are pulling out altogether. Dirk Johnson is Chicago bureau chief for Newsweek magazine. Dirk, the Teamsters are scheduled to hold a news conference at this hour to indicate that they're going independent.
Well, that's the indications they've made so far. It remains to be seen. The dissidents, those who are considering breaking away, represent fully one-third of all the union members.
They include not just the Teamsters, but the SEIU, the Service Employees International Union. That's where John Sweeney himself came from.
Well, that's right. This would be a rebellion from his old ranks. The unions are gathering here for the 50th anniversary, and it's more like a, if not a divorce, at least matrimonial trouble. And it stems from problems that have worsened over the years. There was a time in post-war America where about 25% of American households had a union member. Today it's closer to about 10%. There's been a lot of finger-pointing about how exactly can they stem this decline.
And again, John Sweeney, expected to be reelected as head of the AFL-CIO. One of the things that Andy Stern, among others, his protege at the SEIU, is concerned about. They want new leadership. What do they want the new leadership to do?
Well, they want to spend more money and time on local organizing. They want decentralization of the union. That's to say, keeping more of the money at the local level.
At the local level, as opposed to now sending it to Washington, where it goes out largely to finance Democratic campaigns.
Well, that's right. And the union members, of course, though they've been trending somewhat Republican, still are decisively Democratic in their voting majorities. And, of course, they're a very, very important financial contributor to the Democratic Party.
So this has implications that go way beyond the labor movement. How does the new group, including the Teamsters, the SEIU, and a couple of other big unions as well, as you indicated, one-third of organized labor, how do they expect to do things better than the AFL-CIO?
Well, they seem to think that that it's a matter of management style, new energy, new approach, and again, focusing more on the grassroots local level rather than waiting for marching orders from Washington.
So they want to organize Walmart?
All unions like to organize Walmart. But that expresses very well the major challenge that unions face. Walmart's, of course, the biggest employer in America. It's non-union. And there is, if it clearly is the Goliath, and these days the unions are David.
And what it really represents, too, is the transition from an industrial-based economy, where the AFL-CIO, of course, got its start, into something very different.
Well, absolutely. In fact, the some of the staunchest defenders of the status quo are the machinists, the steel workers, those unions that come out of that old tradition of the old economy.
Globalization, automation, other things that the union movement is accused of not dealing with by these dissidents.
Yes, absolutely.
So what's the atmosphere at the convention, and what's it going to be like at the 50th anniversary of the AFL-CIO getting together after another very historic split?
Well, there's a good deal of acrimony. There's some sense of puzzlement among some of the workers who, after all, some of the union men and women who looked forward to coming to Chicago to urge one another on to have a good time, and they're not exactly sure just what is going on among the power brokers.
Go ahead.
And they're anxious for a resolution. Now how that resolution will settle out is another question, or with whether there'll be a resolution at all.
And the Democrats are certainly hoping for a resolution. Barack Obama and the other senator from Illinois, Durbin, both addressed the convention today kind of delicately, and they're certainly tiptoeing around this issue, but they're looking at the loss of a major base of support if the union movement splits up.
Yeah, absolutely. And over time, of course, there have been individual unions, the Teamsters, for example, who broke away and endorsed Richard Nixon back in the 60s. But when you have one large umbrella organization, and that organization is very strongly behind the Democrats, that's clearly in the Democratic Party's favor.
All right. Very tough times for organized labor right now as it meets once again at a historic moment in Chicago on the 50th anniversary of the AFL-CIO getting together. Seems to be splitting up. Dirk Johnson, again, Chicago Bureau Chief for Newsweek Magazine. Thanks for being with us today.
Good to talk. Thanks.
We'll hear more about this on To the Point later on this week. In a moment, North Korea, the U.S., and nuclear weapons on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warman, I'll be back with To the Point. In the year since disarmament talks were suspended, North Korea claims it's been constructing more nuclear weapons. China, Japan, South Korea, and Russia have agreed to resume discussions tomorrow in Beijing, but today came news of an unexpected development. The U.S. publicly acknowledged bilateral consultations with North Korea, something North Korea has long demanded but which the Bush administration has resisted. William Dobson is managing editor of Foreign Policy magazine. Welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me.
How important are these now acknowledged bilateral consultations that apparently took place last night?
It's very important. This is something entirely new, and it suggests that Washington may be trying to lead with a carrot here, that they're showing a somewhat more flexible posture up front, not something they've been criticized in the past for not doing in the three previous rounds. Assistant Secretary Christopher Hill, his predecessor, Ambassador James Kelly, was criticized by the Chinese involved with the six-party talks for holding to a very tight script. So it's quite possible that they are trying to at least encourage a constructive North Korean response early on.
So what would that mean specifically? Do we have any idea?
Well, you still have a fundamental problem here. I mean, the fundamental problem is still the same, which is the Bush administration is trying to persuade North Korea to dismantle its nuclear weapons program in exchange for aid and recognition from the United States. Now, that said, you may view this as an attempt to try and create some early victories in the week to keep momentum going. The Chinese have wanted that and have been disappointed in the past, and the Chinese particularly want to see enough visible progress early on to ensure that the talks keep going. Now, this is important from Washington's perspective for two reasons. One, it may, in fact, induce the North Koreans to be more cooperative. But more even right away, if that isn't the case, it certainly makes it more difficult for the other parties to the talks to say that it's the Bush administration that's being too rigid, which is something that's been said in the past.
It's also been said in the past that the six-nation talks are really window dressing, that what's important is what goes on between the United States and North Korea. Is that true? And if so, why?
Absolutely. I mean, that's fundamentally where the division lies. That's there won't really be a meaningful agreement unless there's an agreement between Washington and Pyongyang. Initially, to go back even before the six-party talks started, this is what Pyongyang wanted. They wanted bilateral talks. It was the Bush administration that insisted that it become a six-party forum. Now, there's no question that the South Koreans, the Japanese in particular, can be very helpful in trying to get us through some of the initial sequencing of the problem. That's the proposal that's on the table right now. And in that proposal, Japan and South Korea plays a very important part in building the momentum towards an agreement between Washington and Pyongyang. But that is the only assurance that will truly put Pyongyang at ease. And so that's the one they seek.
And by sequencing, you mean a sort of a step-by-step process where you give up your nuclear machinery, we'll provide aid and food,
right,
and how that goes over a long and complicated period.
Yes, where they're going to pick up tomorrow is the U.S., at least the United States is going to be looking to see a response from North Korea about their last offer, which is now over a year old, in which the U.S. said that they could provide, that U.S. allies could provide immediate energy aid for the North if they agreed to end their weapons program. If 3 months later the North revealed its program to outside inspectors and it was verified, then the U.S. would join its allies in giving aid and offering security assurances. But it's sort of a question of who's going to go first.
And terms like security guarantees and verification are very problematic, I guess.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Again, William Dobson's managing editor of Foreign Policy magazine. James R. Lilly is former ambassador to South Korea and to China, assistant secretary of defense during the first Bush administration, now with the American Enterprise Institute. Mr. Ambassador, always good to have you on our program.
Thank you.
Mr. Dobson seems to be at least somewhat encouraged by the fact that there have been now announced by the United States bilateral meetings between the two countries, the United States and North Korea. Do you also feel that this is a reason for optimism?
Well, I think we've been talking with them bilaterally all along. We've met them in Beijing bilaterally. We met them in New York bilaterally. You're saying it probably is just a face issue for the North Koreans, but bilaterals have been going on, and it's part of the six-party talk, so I don't really see a great deal new there. I think it's probably a constructive mood, but it doesn't really change the formula very much.
Doesn't even change it that the United States is willing to provide a situation of face, as you put it, for the North Koreans.
Well, I think that's always a factor in Asia. I think it's probably been overemphasized in the case of North Korea, who gets away with an awful lot of pride and sensitivity, and people don't criticize them because they might throw a tantrum. The South Koreans have done this to the Chinese, and we've sort of toned down our rhetoric. It's, you know, it's a difficult situation because it's a pretty difficult country. There's pretty solid evidence that this country has got one of the worst human rights records in the world and is, of course, is proliferating drugs and counterfeit at a very, very stiff pace in China, all around Asia and Europe. So there's a big problems here, but I think the main thing is you've got the region focusing on the problem. This is not a North Korean-U.S. problem. This is a regional problem, and the South Koreans have come up with a very generous formula to take over a lot of the give that the North Koreans are requiring, and the Chinese, of course, have regularly supplied them with oil and food, probably 50% of their needs. So what we have to try to do is to harness this very generous program with getting them to dismantle their new nuclear program under some sort of verification and also be able to stop any kind of proliferation they might try to engage in.
So you don't think the six-nation talks, then, are window dressing alone?
Absolutely not. I think that this is one of the big moves that was made in the last administration. They didn't make much progress because we all got into catfights with our friends and allies, and the North Koreans played us off beautifully against each other, and they made the issue the United States, not their nuclear weapons program. The issue is their need for security guarantees and talks with the United States, not their nuclear weapons program. And I think we have to keep the emphasis right on that, but we've also got to buy the Chinese different agenda, the South Korea different agenda, because their agendas aren't ours. They're different.
Former Ambassador James Lilly, back to William Dobson with Foreign Policy Magazine. Not window dressing. Six power talks are really important, according to the former ambassador.
Well, I think we're splitting hairs here a little bit. I mean, my feeling is that it's nothing new that the region is focusing on this problem. In fact, I think that's the region has been focusing on the problem all the way back to 2003 when the six-party talks started. The real drag here over the last couple of years has been the Bush administration. And what I find encouraging about this opening round right now is that you have the Bush administration focusing on the problem. And in part, in its actions, it could be suggest at least that they're listening to some of the other parties who said, couldn't you be more constructive? Couldn't you listen more and take a more flexible approach when dealing with the North Koreans? I agree entirely with the ambassador that it's a very small concession for the Bush administration to give up at all, but it could be meaningful. And right now, given that you haven't had talks for a year, any progress is something to applaud.
Yeah, Mr. Ambassador, has the Bush administration been a real drag?
Well, I think in the first administration, they were feeling their way on this one, and they were trying a different approach. They wanted to break away from the so-called bribery of the 90s, where the North Koreans were getting these huge sums of money and food and grain, and were shutting down their known nuclear program and were engaging in a secret program on the side, a highly enriched uranium program. And I think they went into mild shock on this, and they confronted them. And, of course, it didn't work very well. But what they've worked at recently with Chris Hill taking over is a very assiduous approach to our friends and allies. Let's get together on this. This is your problem. It's our problem. You have the resources to take care of their needs. We will certainly look into the security problem. Even we'll look at a peace treaty. We'll take a wide-ranging view on this. We've got a lot of things on the table. I think it's very interesting that the South Korean representative came up with this talk about a framework for denuclearization on the Korean Peninsula. And I think this is quite important, that the six-party talks be turned into some sort of a permanent regional security economic organization that would denuclearize the peninsula and work in a developmental aid program which would be supported by all parties and would bring North Korea out of its very, very difficult economic situation, which I think is forcing their hand in these rather exorbitant demands they're making.
Again, former Ambassador James Lilly. Joseph Cerencioni is Director and Senior Associate of the Nonproliferation Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's also author of Deadly Arsenals, Tracking Weapons of Mass Destruction. Your title says it all, Deadly Arsenals. We are talking about something very significant here. Mr. Cerencioni, do you think that one ought to be more optimistic as a result of these talks that are apparently taking place between the U.S. and North Korea?
I think the word that everybody uses is guardedly optimistic. There's nothing easy about negotiating with the North Koreans, but the both sides are making the right noises in the weeks coming up. And I give a lot of credit to Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. I think she has been slowly, incrementally changing administration policy on here, moving away from the failed policy of the first administration that what Ambassador Lilly just made reference to, this view that we could overthrow the regime, that we didn't have to make a deal with them, that we could one way or another get rid of the regime. That's why we put them on our hit list, the so-called Axis of Evil states. When former Undersecretary of State John Bolton was asked what lesson Iran and North Korea should take from the Iraq War, he said they should take a number. And the idea was that by invading Iraq, we would make a message to these other countries that they should give up their programs or else. That message backfired. Both Iran and North Korea actually accelerated their programs already underway. That plan didn't work. Plan B for the administration was to get China to do it, to somehow lean on China, get them to cut off their aid and energy supplies to North Korea. China doesn't want to do that. They don't want a nuclear Korea, but they don't want a destabilized nuclear Korea either. So now we're on plan C, which is to actually see if we can make a deal. Can we do with Kim Jong-il what we did with Muammar Gaddafi?
Of course, one of the reasons China doesn't want to see destabilization is that there might be an enormous refugee problem. South Korea presumably is concerned about that as well.
Exactly. And there's been this split between Washington, which was in favor of a hard landing, overthrow the regime, topple them one way or the other, and the Chinese and the South Koreans, who were trying to do a soft landing, bring this regime down slowly, by engagement, by opening it up, and we're about to test whether we can actually achieve a soft landing. I'm guardedly optimistic. I think the North Koreans could be convinced to make a deal. And the goal is exactly what President Bush says it should be: complete, irreversible, verifiable dismantlement. We're not talking about a freeze. We're not talking about partial steps. You got to go the whole way. And what we have to argue about now is what Will Dobson said, the sequencing. Can we get the sequencing right so that we can actually make steady progress towards that goal?
Joseph Cerencioni with the Carnegie Endowment. Back to former Ambassador Lilly. When you're talking about a complete downsizing or elimination, I guess, irreversible of the nuclear program, you're also talking about inspections, and there have been problems about sovereignty. Do you think that those are possible to overcome?
They'll be very tough. Let me just one correction. I've never advocated overthrow of the North Korean regime. That is impossible. It was in the beginning. It was never a possibility. It was just a lot of tough talk, in my view. As far as getting a deal with them, it will be most difficult. You're going to have to settle for probably three-quarters of it. Your intelligence is not good on North Korea. I think that was pointed out by the New York Times today. It really is messy intelligence coverage. It's probably even weaker than we had on Iraq. But, yes, I think you can move this forward. We've established the precedent of some kind of economic aid program for movement on their nuclear weapons program. Now what we've got to do is to carry it the step forward and say these are linked. And this huge energy program that the South Koreans have come up with, 500,000 tons of rice, and the possibility the United States could come in on this and Japanese reparations could come in on this, hold out the pot of gold for them, but keep it back until they show us some real results this time. And I think, I think this is correct, that we've got to get at this nuclear program, and we've particularly got to stop it because we cannot have any of this proliferation. They are putting these drugs and counterfeits out through the mafia and triads. They've established those connections. They could substitute weapons of mass destruction into that, which would be very dangerous. And I think we've got to nip that in the bud.
Again, Joseph Cerencioni, back to you. Do you feel that then South Korea and the other nations involved are very much a part of all of this, and rather than being window dressing?
They are very much a part of it, and the president was right to put together the six-party framework. The problem was that once we agreed on the shape of the table, we never put anything on the table. We got the six-party talks together, and they became sort of the process became an end in itself. There was never actually any negotiations, and that's why our allies, Japan at various points, but mostly South Korea, and our friends, in this case, at least momentarily, China, we're saying get real about this, put some substance there, engage in bilateral talks within the framework of the six-party talks. That's what we're now doing. That's what was blocked during the first administration, but Condoleezza Rice has moved us steadily in that path, and it's starting to pay off, and that's good news for the president. He needs a victory. He doesn't have much to show in his foreign policy.
In a moment, what does a war game with North Korea look like? What's it like to live in North Korea? On Reporter's Notebook, even if fuel sensor problems continue, NASA will launch Discovery tomorrow. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. A final question on the issue of tomorrow's six-nation talks beginning in Beijing, talking, of course, about the eventual nuclear disarmament, much hoped for, of North Korea. William Dobson with Foreign Policy. What's the best scenario that you could give us for the rest of this week?
It's going to be very difficult, and I think everyone else has made that point very clearly. I think that the best scenario for this week is to have an agreement that they keep on talking right now. I want to go back and just say that I do think that the other country's role is very important, but at the end of the day, no one wants a five-party deal. they need a six-party deal. And for that to happen, you need to square the differences between Washington and North Korea, and that's probably not going to happen this week. That's why I would suspect that they're looking at least to find some low-hanging fruit to make it clear that talks are progressing, there's a reason to keep people focused and at the table, and hopefully in a later round, Joe Cerencioni's guarded optimism will bear fruit.
William Dobson of Foreign Policy Magazine, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks also to former Ambassador James Lilly and Joseph Cerencioni of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington. The latest issue of the Atlantic Monthly concludes that, quote, dealing with North Korea could make Iraq look like child's play, close quote. Scott Stossel reports in the magazine on a Pentagon-style war game with surrogates for America's top officials. Scott Stossel, welcome to our program.
Thanks for having me.
Strong language, dealing with North Korea could make Iraq look like child's play. What do you mean?
Well, actually, in that specific quote is referring, I'm actually quoting David Kay, the former CIA-appointed Iraqi arms inspector, and he was actually speaking about two things, really, that the direct military engagement with North Korea could, most Pentagon analysts agree, would be the worst engagement certainly since Vietnam, possibly since World War II. Specifically, what Kay was talking about, though, is that even if we won, we achieved victory in Iraq, but it was sort of a catastrophic victory as things have turned out. The reason that North Korea could be even more dangerous is because we are know with a much greater degree of confidence that they do possess weapons of mass destruction, not only nuclear weapons, but also chemical and biological. And if we won a conventional encounter with them, we would still need to have so many troops on the ground in order to assure that the weapons of mass destruction were kept secure and not transferred into smugglers' or terrorists' hands, that's what would make Iraq look like child play. Iraq itself is kind of a nightmare right now, but at least most of the insurgency is staying in Iraq, and there to date haven't been any weapons of mass destruction discovered that might have made their way out of there.
New York Times reports at great length today, and a couple of our guests referred to it earlier, that intelligence on North Korea may be even worse than it was on Iraq, with a lot of it based on satellite photography that's very difficult to interpret and has left the intelligence community arguing among itself as to what exactly is going on there. How do we know they have weapons of mass destruction, including nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons?
Well, it's true. We can't know with 100% certainty anything. And actually, if the Iraq situation showed us anything, it's that, you know, it used to be before Saddam Hussein, we sort of assumed that everyone was pretending to abide by the rules of international law, but secretly violating them. You know, we assumed that Saddam Hussein was pretending like he was obeying the rules, but actually had weapons of mass destruction. And in fact, he didn't. He was pretending that he had weapons of mass destruction, but really didn't. That could theoretically be the case, but and it's also true what the New York Times reports, that our intelligence in general about both Iran and Iraq is much, much better than it is about North Korea generally, both about their intentions and their capabilities. That said, based on satellite photography and based on what we know from negotiations and we know from when there were weapons inspectors there back in the early 90s and intermittently since then, that they do have nuclear reactors that have been shut down from time to time. And the logical conclusion is that they've been removing spent fuel rods, which can be used to build nuclear bombs. And yes, it's true, they could be bluffing, but there's strong reasons to suppose that they have not only nuclear weapons, but also a wide variety of biological and chemical weapons.
You talked about the possible catastrophe of a victory. What about what your earlier comment that David Kay believes that a direct engagement might be the worst since Vietnam or possibly since World War II? Are we talking there about conventional weapons?
It's possibly conventional weapons. It sort of brings in the threat of that North Korea would use either biological or chemical weapons or possibly nuclear. A lot of it has to do with the fact that the geography of the Korean Peninsula is such that the DMZ falls just 30 miles or so north of Seoul, which is the capital of South Korea, where there are 30 million or 40 million people, including 100,000 Americans. And if North Korea chose, they could, in effect, their forward-positioned artillery units are within range of Seoul, so that even in a conventional ground war, military experts don't doubt that if it was just their ground troops against our ground troops, or even against the South Korean ground troops, the good guys would win. The problem is that in the event that North Korea was losing, as inevitably they would, they might decide to, in effect, use Seoul as a hostage and threaten to, or in fact, actually do as one of their ministers once threatened and turn Seoul into a sea of fire. And, you know, the estimates from the Pentagon are actually that you could have anywhere between 50 and 100,000 dead in just the first 30 days or so of fighting. And, you know, right there, you're at a level of casualties that far exceeds Iraq. If you really did take out Seoul and you hadn't evacuated the 100,000 Americans, you're already at a level of higher than the 58,000 Americans who died in Vietnam. And even if you did evacuate them, just the what it would take to actually occupy and secure the weapons of mass destruction, based on the size of the territory and the size of the population, you know, you'd probably need 500,000 troops.
What about ballistic missiles, and what range is it thought that North Korea might be able to attain?
Well, this is one of the great unknowns. Nobody really knows for sure. What we do know is that they have tested what they call these Taipodong 1 and are working on Taipodong 2 missiles. They fired one over Japan. We know for sure that with Scuds and so forth, the sort of rudimentary technology that was being used by Saddam Hussein back in the Gulf War, they can certainly strike all over South Korea and probably as far as Japan. With the next more distant range of technology, they can probably fire in a range that would hit U.S. troops in Guam or Okinawa. And we know they're working on more advanced stage missiles, that the Taipodong 2 missile, that could theoretically strike the west coast of the United States.
So when you say they are working on and they are developing, and it is thought that they may be able to have, time, it would appear, is not on our side.
No, and the reason why time is especially not on our side, I mean, what complicates everything dealing with North Korea in particular is that, you know, the real threat to U.S. national security, leaving aside, you know, the very important issue of our allies, national security, South Korea, is not that they would necessarily launch a missile at us, or that we would lose a conventional military engagement with us. It's that as they produce more and more nuclear missiles, and they're believed, and again, this is all guessing work, but they're believed to possess at least, you know, 6, 8, 10 now, and possibly with the ability to churn out a couple more per year. Because they're in such dire straits financially all the time, you know, they have an enormous incentive to try and sell them. So the real threat that we're having to guard against is not necessarily a conventional war with North Korea, but the threat that they distribute them to terrorists, distribute nuclear weapons or weapons of mass destruction to terrorists, and a bomb goes off in Washington or New York or Los Angeles. Which leads to the question of at what point do we need to preemptively attack in order to assure that that doesn't happen? The more, I mean, it may be that we've already passed the point of no return if they have more than just a few missiles, enough to, you know, launch a couple and have a few in reserve. They may feel that they're at the point where they can sell. But certainly, you know, as time goes on and we allow them to keep building more nuclear weapons, the more likely it is that they'll sell one, which makes it why it's so important these six-party talks resume and continue, because the longer we keep talking and stay engaged, the less likely a really horrible outcome is to result.
Well, thank you very much. You've really given us a sense of how urgent this matter is. Scott Stossel, again, senior editor for The Atlantic Monthly magazine, and this month's issue has a report on that war game, very much worth reading. The other question becomes, of course, what is life like in North Korea? There was talk early in the Bush administration about the possible collapse of the regime because of opposition within. There's somewhat more known about it now than was before, because people have defected from that country, made themselves available to some Western reporters, and they include Barbara Demick, who is the South Korea bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. Barbara Demick, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
What have we learned in the past few months about the stability of that regime, the popularity of it on the part of the people who live in North Korea? And I guess the basic question here, and perhaps the most important, the one to begin with, is what is their life like?
Well, I think I'll answer the last question first. I think their life is pretty grim. Everything that I'm hearing from North Korean defectors and also people who have come out and are working in China as essentially migrant workers is that they are still living in a situation of famine. The average salary in North Korea is now about $1 a month, which is really staggering. And somebody who's working full-time as a factory worker or living on a pension, a teacher, literally can't afford to feed himself more than a few days a month, let alone feed a family. So I think you're looking at a country that where the people are very much on the edge. I just completed a very long project looking at daily life in one city, Changchun, which is in the northeast. And what I found is that there wasn't the same kind of famine there was in the 90s with people, you know, dropping dead on the streets, but there were still very high death rates from the famine. Unfortunately, going to your first and second questions, that doesn't necessarily translate into political dissent or instability for the regime. The people in North Korea have very little power to determine their fate and, you know, the doings of their government. So they seem to suffer, at least for us, you know, in silence.
Do they have a way of comparing their government to what's going on in other parts of the world?
You know, it's funny. In the past, they didn't at all. And North Koreans have often told me, we're like frogs in the well. We have no idea what's on the outside. That's the phrase they use. I think, though, that North Korea is not as impermeable as it once was. And where the information blockade is breaking down is through China, not through the demilitarized zone of South Korea, but there is an 800-mile border between China and North Korea. And increasingly, North Koreans go to China to work or to beg money, and they'll come back and they bring, you know, tales from the outside. And that has been very corrosive for the North Korean regime. North Koreans in the past used to think they were, you know, very lucky to be North Korean and, you know, vastly richer and superior to the Chinese. And I've heard this many times from North Koreans. They go to China and they're stunned to find out that the Chinese eat, for example, rice every day. For an average North Korean, rice is a luxury. You're lucky if you can eat corn every day or some, you know, combination of corn and grass. But when North Koreans go to China and they see that they're eating rice, they, you know, begin to realize that they are in very dire circumstances. And I think they're not as in the dark as they once were.
In one of your stories, you describe an extraordinary situation where a woman, realizing that she's not going to be able to survive, bribes a bureaucrat so she could sell her apartment. And then I'm now reading from your story, with no business skills other than the ability to calculate on an abacus, used the proceeds of the sale to set herself up in a black market business, hawking biscuits and moonshine that she brewed from corn. She could have been sent away for life for these crimes, but obeying the rules would have meant a death sentence. How many people are there like that?
I think probably 80% of the population is in that situation. As I said, if you are in a regular job, working for the government, being a civil servant, playing by the rules, you're on the verge of starvation. This same woman in my story told me, she said, you know, it was the people who played by the rules who died first. If you did what you were told, you're already dead. So everybody is kind of out looking for ways to make money, and the government is no longer controlling people's means of survival, and that has made the government a lot weaker. And it doesn't mean that people aren't still terrified of this regime, which, you know, as I think you know, has a, you know, horrific reputation for human rights, and people are sent to political prisons if they rebel openly. So I don't see any massive rebellion, but people are not playing by the rules the way they used to because they have to survive.
And here's a man you quote, a coal miner who you say you were interviewed during a visit to China. He says people are not stupid. Everybody thinks our own government is to blame for our terrible situation, but we don't need to talk about that. So that suggests, I gather, the fear of reprisal.
Exactly. And under the North Korean criminal code, if you are charged with committing a political crime, your whole family is punished through three generations. That means your kids, your grandkids, your parents can be sent away to a political prison, and that's chilling. Another woman in my story said if you had one life to live, you might give it to get rid of this regime, but you don't want your family to suffer. And that keeps people silent, but perhaps nowadays sullenly silent, where they know, but they don't talk about it.
What about reports that while all this is going on amongst the general population, the ruler of North Korea, Kim Il-sung, and his confreres, and I gather high officials in the military as well, live pretty well?
Well, Kim Jong-il, who's
Kim
Jong-il, who's the son of North Korea's founder, is probably the biggest gourmet in Asia, and we've written about this quite a bit. He imports his sushi chef from Japan. He brings cheeses from France. He brings wines. He was once reputed to be the largest customer for Hennessy Cognac during the 90s, when more than 10% of the North Korean population died of starvation. He was spending $100, $200 for a single piece of rice cake. He's very picky about his food. I think some of his excesses have been moderated in the last few years simply because he's old and overweight, and he's been told he has to cut back. But there is, you know, nothing that's too good for the leadership.
Do people in North Korea in general know about that?
I would be shocked if they know about it. And in fact, the North Korean propaganda machine will spin out tales about how Kim Jong-il, you know, went to visit soldiers and enjoyed, you know, a simple meal of a potato or a bit of cabbage. They make quite a bit of that. I think very few people know what he eats, although there's, I think, a general wariness of Kim Jong-il that didn't exist in the case of his father. I think Kim Il-sung was genuinely beloved by many people. But the sense I get speaking to refugees is that the son, Kim Jong-il, is unpopular, and that there's at least, you know, an inkling that he might not be out for their best interest.
Even so, the word propaganda would seem to answer a lot of questions that would occur in the minds of a Westerner when you describe the situation that you do.
Well, the propaganda is very strong in North Korea. There are no newspapers from outside. There's no radios. North Korean radios are famously fixed to a single station, so you can't listen to a radio report from China or a radio report from South Korea. So they do hear very little of what the outside world knows. What little they know is word of mouth.
Well, thank you very much, Barbara Demick, for that perspective on what's going on in North Korea.
Thanks very much.
Good to have you with us, South Korea Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks to her. Thanks to Scott Stossel, also senior editor for the Atlantic Monthly, who talked about the military situation there, and our other guest today talking about North Korea as well. Once again, the six-party talks beginning again tomorrow. Almost 2 weeks ago, the Space Shuttle Discovery was grounded because one of four fuel sensors failed to operate properly. The cause of the problem has not been found, but NASA says it'll go ahead anyway with another planned launch tomorrow. More on that in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Werman Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. NASA's rule is that all four hydrogen fuel sensors are supposed to be working, but it will waive that rule tomorrow, even if Discovery's troublesome fuel sensor still isn't operating correctly. Michael Cabbage is aerospace editor of the Orlando Sentinel, co-author of Calm Check, the final flight of the shuttle Columbia. Joins us from Cape Canaveral. Thanks again, Michael Cabbage, for being with us.
My pleasure.
Why, having stalled the flight a little more than a week ago for this reason, is NASA now willing to go ahead, even though it hasn't figured out what went wrong?
Well, there's several reasons for that. First off, they've spent the last week and a half troubleshooting this problem in every way imaginable. They've changed out an electronics box that some of the circuitry runs to. They've switched circuits between some of these fuel sensors. They've looked at almost everything imaginable to try and convince themselves that they don't have a generic problem here, and that this is something that they understand. The other reason is that this system, while it is an important backup system, is one for it to take effect, you would have to have multiple failures above it. And NASA has convinced itself, I believe, that to get to the place where this system would actually have to operate, the odds are so high that it's very unlikely. unlikely.
So it's NASA's convinced itself. How about the astronauts? Have they been convinced?
I believe they have. In fact, retired Air Force Colonel Eileen Collins, who is commanding this mission, arrived with the rest of her crew at Kennedy Space Center for flight on Friday. And in a brief talk with the reporters that were gathered there at the shuttle landing strip, she mentioned the fact that some of the members of the crew had been participating in the technical and the management meetings, and that they were very satisfied with the progress. And in fact, she characterized the launch plan as great, quote unquote.
Is there pressure because of the window needed to launch in order to accomplish the missions that Discovery is supposed to perform?
There is, without a doubt. It's been 2.5 years since the space shuttle launched, and it's been even longer than that since a space shuttle visited the International Space Station. The International Space Station, there are certain supplies that it depends on the shuttle to bring up, and in fact, there's some cargo and some hardware that is so massive that it can't fly on the other cargo rockets that are launched from Russia periodically. So the shuttle badly needs to visit the International Space Station again. And beyond that, there's this perception in the minds of many people within NASA that if they don't return the shuttle to flight soon, that it's going to really reflect on the program's credibility and could impact how many more missions they have to fly in the future.
How about the weather?
The weather, as always in Florida in August, is unpredictable. The official forecast right now says there's a 60% chance of having good conditions for launch, but here in Florida in July, there's always the chance of that stray thunderstorm popping up at any time. And interestingly enough, it's not just the weather here in Florida that could potentially be an issue. The shuttle has three emergency landing sites in Europe that at least one of those has to have good weather conditions for the shuttle to launch. And two of those are in Spain, and one of them is in France. And one of the Spanish sites and the French site, both are forecast to have weather that is out of limits. And the other Spanish site is forecast to have winds that are right at the upper limit. So they'll be watching the weather in Europe as well as here at the Cape tomorrow.
Have they ever landed in Europe? It seemed to me that when they need an emergency landing site, they usually choose California.
They have never landed in Europe, and where the emergency landing site is depends on how far the shuttle gets in its launch, in its ascent toward orbit, before it has some sort of an engine problem or something that would make it have to make an emergency landing. If it's in the very initial stages, then the shuttle would come back to Kennedy Space Center. If it's slightly farther in during ascent, then they would land in Europe, and if they had enough energy to sort of limp to orbit, then they would probably land at Edwards Air Force Base in California or at White Sands Missile Range in New Mexico.
Again, we're talking with Michael Cabbage, aerospace editor of the Orlando Sentinel. You've been doing this for a long time, studying this situation. You're author of ComCheck, The Final Flight of the Shuttle Columbia, which, of course, makes chills run up and down your spine. How would you feel about this fuel sensor problem if you were an astronaut? You used the term that NASA was able to convince itself and the astronauts were able to convince themselves that things were okay. How would you feel about it?
I think they have enough safeguards built into the system to where this really isn't an incredibly risky thing they're doing here. They have a plan in place where they're going to be watching the sensor that failed the last time as well as another sensor that they switched its circuit with. And if they see a problem that they recognize, a problem identical to the last time that they tried to launch on July 13th, then they're probably going to make the decision to press ahead. But if they see anything that they haven't seen before and that they really aren't positive that they understand, then they're going to stand down. And they'll probably wind up standing down, in fact, until September if that happens.
What do these sensors do, if it's possible to explain that briefly to a lay audience?
Sure. Ordinarily, when the shuttle launches, when it reaches a certain velocity fast enough to carry it into orbit, there are instruments on the shuttle that signal to the flight computers on the shuttle that, okay, it's time to shut the engines off because we're going fast enough to get to the orbit that we want to get to. If for some reason though that system fails, these sensors are in the bottom of the giant external fuel tank, and what they do is they alert the flight computers that, okay, the level of liquid hydrogen or the level of liquid oxygen, which are the two propellants that the shuttle's three main engines run on, it's so low right now that it's time to shut the engines off, because if you run out of either the liquid hydrogen or the liquid oxygen and you're only burning one sort of fuel, it can become potentially very dangerous. So the point of the sensors is if this the usual method of the shuttle's engines being turned off when the shuttle reaches orbital velocity fails, this is a backup system that will cut the engines off before they start running on only one sort of propellant or no propellant at all, which can make very bad things happen.
And by very bad things and danger, explosion is one of them, is it not?
It could potentially be. It certainly, I would think, would destroy the engine and could damage parts of the orbiter beyond that.
Quickly, what do you think of the chances of launch tomorrow?
That's the $64,000 question. You never know on a July day in Florida, but it's Wayne Hale, who's the deputy shuttle program manager, seemed to say it best yesterday when he said, when the weather cooperates, it seems like the hardware doesn't, and when the hardware cooperates, it seems like the weather doesn't. So hopefully they'll get lucky on both counts tomorrow.
Hopefully indeed. Michael Cabbage, aerospace editor, Orlando Sentinel, co-author, of ComCheck, the final flight of Shuttle Columbia. Thanks a lot for being with us.
My pleasure.
Today's program produced by Jonah King, with Karen Ratzinger and Sharon Rimbaum, Technical Director Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warman Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.